The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
I have a very special guest here, and today we are going to be digging into a high-stakes diplomatic standoff between Trinidad and Tobago and Venezuela that's playing out loudly, publicly, and at times dangerously. Now, you remember for the past few days or weeks, you know, we've been feeling that kind of tension. Now, this growing tension on the seas have pushed both governments into the spotlight. And our guest today is Mwale, or Mwale Henry, Executive Leadership Advisor, Behavioral Pollster, and author of a thought-provoking piece titled Diplomacy in the Age of Decibels. So help me, guys. Help me welcome Mr. Henry. Good afternoon, Mr. Henry. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to your viewers. Thank you so much for having me.
Was I pronouncing your name properly? Is it Mwale or Mwale?
Mwale.
Mwale. I love it. Yeah. That's an amazing name. So let's get into it. All right. And of course, let me just invite our listeners. You know, they may have some questions for you. If that's okay, they could send it via WhatsApp 306-1065. Or we'll be taking calls maybe in the next 20 to 30 minutes or so that they can ask you and you can respond accordingly. Yeah.
Of course, Carrie. Looking forward to it.
That would be nice. So let's get with it. Let's start with the title. Diplomacy in the Age of Decibels, a powerful phrase. And what inspired that? And what are you saying about how diplomacy has changed?
Well, we are in the Western Hemisphere. And with the incoming of a new president, we see his style is quite different. And he's bringing his business acumen, New York style business acumen, and those winds are blowing in our Western Hemisphere. That is changing the style of how we do business, how we trade, how we negotiate. So when we see these types of tensions that are happening, because historically we've had a long standing relationship with Venezuela, right?
Yeah.
1978, we had our treaty in position that supported trade and maritime boundaries. So nothing new. Our neighbor is no one new to us. But clearly, because of the dynamics that is happening in our region, we see this approach that Venezuela is taking and Trinidad is responding.
Nice. Now, the tension exploded after claims that Trinidadians were part of a plot to destabilize the Maduro government. How did that story even unfold? And what do you make of the way that it was handled publicly? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, as I said before, you know, it is uncommon for the president of Venezuela historically to take publicly to issues that are taking place between Trinidad and Venezuela. Now, let's look at it. If I have to analyze what we are seeing, I will place it in three categories. You know, what has changed, why it has changed, and what needs to change. So what has changed is that Venezuela historically has a diplomatic style that is very public, right? They're coming from Bolivarian type style of diplomacy. So it's very militaristic, very, you know, bombastic, anti-American. It's very public and is used for a lot of stability for their country. Whilst it has a style that is, we follow the Commonwealth type of tradition, which is non-aligned, diplomatic, you know, middle of the road, that type of thing. However, whenever we intersect between Venezuela and Trinidad is in our non-aligned movement, where Venezuela understands that Trinidad is part of that non-aligned movement that wants to be able to be pragmatic and to dance. So traditionally, diplomatic private channels
are recording in progress
to have these types of conversations. However, the question that you just asked is the question I asked myself: why did President Maduro decide to take a public stance, you know, regards to these security threats, as he enunciated, followed up by his Minister of Interior, identifying a Trinidadian. This was released again sometime this week. So for me, I would hazard, I guess, to say it is directly linked to our evolving relationship with the U.S. and it's probably a little too close for comfort for Caracas.
It is actually. And as you mentioned before, you know, we had a different diplomatic style and the way how we deal with issues. But this is an issue that now to me, and I don't know if our listeners who are listening right now, you know, the older folks, I've never been aware of something like this before, whereby, let's say, for instance, what happened in Venezuela, the President Maduro said, listen, it had trainees, they are mercenaries, and they want to destabilize my country. And then, of course, our Prime Minister, Kamala Pisabi, says, good afternoon to you, ma'am, if you're locked on and you're listening. She said, well, listen, just don't come in my place, you know. Don't come in my territory. Else, it's full force we're dealing with you. So when I've heard that response, you know, my tingly senses went up, because now I feel as though that something is going to happen. Now, the response from us, our leadership, it wasn't even quiet either, right? So our Prime Minister, she went as far as to authorize a deadly force at the sea. What does this kind of language mean in diplomatic terms, that is, that could actually escalate things further? What does that mean for us?
Well, you know, if you study the rules of the sea, you know, as a former naval officer, we know and understand that that is already entrenched in our laws. How do we deal with external incursions?
Mm-hmm.
So from a diplomatic perspective, that wasn't needed to be said, mm-hmm. All right? Understood in international relations. So the mere fact that the Prime Minister, the Honorable Kamala Pisabi Sessa, decided to use that language, funny enough, she borrowed from President Maduro's diplomatic language, because Venezuela is known to be bombastic, to be very outwardly, you know, expressive
mm-hmm.
in how to deal with diplomatic issues. So it was definitely out of sorts and not in line with our diplomatic practice in our Commonwealth tradition. You know, it is clear that followed up from her comments, you know, the Honorable Prime Minister indicated that, no, we're at peace with our neighbor. So I'm seeing a softening of the approach,
mm-hmm.
some form of opening down on that approach. I'm happy that our present Minister of Foreign Affairs, Foreign and CARICOM Affairs, met with his counterpart,
mm-hmm.
the Venezuelan ambassador. So it is my hope that, as our customs and our conventions has been, that there will be some sort of back-channeling and conversing of what are these differences, confirmation of this intelligence and claim that Venezuela is making
mm-hmm.
of a citizen of our country being part of a security, direct security threat. And interestingly enough, you know, Carrie, I will say this, it is not the first time that Venezuela has made claims of security threats external. It's been Colombia, it's been U.S.
Guyana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but in all those claims, what has been a constant golden thread has been the shadow hand of the U.S. Because
right.
the claim Venezuela has made, they have attached Colombia, they have attached Guyana, and now, in our first time, they are attaching Trinidad as being proxies who are being used either directly or indirectly
mm-hmm.
to form incursions into Venezuela. And that, for me, is where my main interest lies.
Right. And because we've had a lot of collaboration with the U.S. in terms of doing exercises, I can't remember the exact name they call it, over the past few weeks, the exercises
trade
that
wind.
They had. Trade winds, yes. Trade winds. Thanks so much. Do you think that Venezuela is seeing that and probably saying, but listen, well, what's happening here? They're coming in, we cousin island? No. We had to see if we could get involved into this. Do you think that they are looking at it as a threat from the U.S.? What's your thoughts on it?
Truth is, you know, sometimes we say things like there's no such thing as a coincidence, right?
Mm.
Trade winds exercise. But I would say it was a coincidence because this happened under the last administration, before the inclusion of this new, incoming of this new administration.
Mm-hmm.
And moreover, the U.S. is one of our closest trading partners. 80% of our resources exports go to the U.S. market.
Mm-hmm.
We presently have, you know, security arrangements, the Caribbean Basin Security Initiatives for technical assistance and field teams. So it is not new, and it's not new to Venezuela. Mm-hmm. It is not the first time we're having an exercise. So I wouldn't place too much emphasis on the security exercise that takes place unless Venezuela has intelligence that these exercises, within these exercises, there was some form of threat towards them or preparation, but there's no evidence, so I wouldn't go down the alarmist route. But what I would say that is a bit different in the U.S. Engagement in this administration, within less than a month and a half, the current charge of the affairs of the U.S. Embassy has engaged quite normally the new administration, which is quite normal. However, what I observed uniquely is that usually when the U.S. would engage a new administration, it would be at the level of the prime minister in the area of trade and national security. But if you observe, this engagement went as far as the Ministry of Housing. This engagement went as far as the Ministry of Social Development or People, Social and People Development. I don't know if I'm saying the ministry correct. But so when you see these engagements happening throughout the length and breadth of its cabinet, similarly, then obviously one has to take notice that truly the U.S. is taking a keen interest of being a very present partner.
And we've noticed that, we've seen that. Now, let's get back to the article that you wrote, right? In that article, you noted that some leaders like the MSJs, David Abdullah, we even heard from our previous Prime Minister, Dr. Keith Rowley, they call for more discreet diplomacy. And his words were, you know, what kind of thing is I doing, Prime Minister? That, you know, that was foolish. Right? Why do you think the government opted for a public confrontational stance instead? Do you think that that is now going to be our style of diplomacy, especially with this administration? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, if we were to analyze and probably even, you know, guess what would have been the reasons, some people say, hey, the reason that this administration is having a diametrical positioning towards Venezuela is because of our energy deals with the Dragon gas, cross-border gas deals. That might be the reason, but I would challenge that can't be the reason, because in 2013, the then Prime Minister, Kamla Pusat-Bisesa, now Prime Minister again, would have signed energy deals to deepen cooperation with Venezuela. Our Prime Minister is familiar with Venezuela and also saw the wisdom of cross-border gas. So I would not say it's because of a soaring of energy deals. Some people say, well, it's probably because of sanctions, all right? You know, U.S. has a diametrical view towards Venezuela, and sanctions may be a concern for them. And I would say no, because since 2000, the U.S. had sanctions, targeted sanctions against PDVSA, 2020, actually, if you read the executive order 13850, they would have had targeted sanctions against Venezuela.
Right.
And you know what? Our prime minister was engaging that same Venezuela and that same company while they were under sanctions. So I would not say that it is about sanctions. I would not even say it's about democracy. Some of the things people are floating, you know, it's a narco state, all these different titles.
Right.
I would suggest the reason of this public posture is because of serious crosswinds that are coming through our region that is influencing the posture of this administration.
Right.
I am not that, you know, they are being pushed over by the U.S., but the influence is clearly there. There's a break from tradition, and there isn't any facts economically, strategically, or socially that tells me that we have a new policy position for Venezuela or how we operate within the region.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned region, and you touched on the U.S. role behind the scenes. Right? How much is U.S. foreign policy shaping the way Caribbean nations like us or even Guyana handle countries like Venezuela? How do you think that their foreign policy right now shaping that?
Well, you know, I use a term, it's called, you know, when we look at the U.S. policy, it's creating some form of diplomatic schizophrenia within our region. I could just stay at home at one point in time. Across administration, UNC administration, People's National Movement Administration had a positive posture towards Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
We have Cuban doctors and nurses through its program. It was something that was done and practiced continuously. And in comes the Secretary of State, Secretary Rubio,
mm-hmm.
made it very clear that the U.S. positioning is whatsoever makes the U.S. much more stronger,
mm-hmm.
prosperous, and And he attacked this Cuban policy. And from the time he attacked this Cuban policy of having that medical assistance, well, then UNC in opposition agreed.
Right.
And it was intuitive to what they would have supported before. So I would say that it is normal, and I just want your listeners to know this, it is normal for governments to change policy, to have a different view, and more. I will be one of the first to indicate that this administration has a right to dictate the strategic foreign policy direction that they would want to take. They have a mandate, they are the government, but there has to be justification. And I believe this might be the best time for the now Minister of Foreign and CARICOM Affairs to enunciate what is our new foreign policy positioning and what is the justification for this change.
Right, nice. So it's more like, so what you're saying more or less in your article, and before we head to the break, I want you to just give us a synopsis of the article in case there are listeners, you know, wondering what article we are speaking about. You can even tell them where they can go to read it. You know, you were explaining it bit by bit, and as I read it, I understood. Right? But do you see this as like a one-off kind of clash, or is it just part of a deeper regional power shift? Is it like a one-off kind of thing? You know, we just throw a few words up in the air and then it just die a natural death. Or is it something is the beginning of something worse to come?
Good question. So for me, I think it's the beginning of more to come. Ooh. The more to come component may not be conflict. It may not be wars. You know, we saw so many memes of people comparing what Venezuela has and we have guns on fort. people, as Trinbegonians, right? How we deal with
sun. What right? you studying on your computer?
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
It's okay. We mock and mimic our experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not go down that road of fear mongering. But what I would suggest is that there will be an intentional moving away from our neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
The prime minister would have made that very clear by saying Dragon is dead. And more so if we consider the future of our energy industry and the future of our maritime borders and trade, I think that is going to become into keen focus. And finally, my question will be, how do we make up for the gap in our energy deficit?
Right.
And that find us leaning more on America and American influence in bringing some form of energy reserves into our region.
Mm-hmm. So the possibility exists that this could go on for a longer period.
It does. It does exist that it will go on for a protracted period, because if we follow, success leaves clues, right? If we follow the posture of this prime minister, then opposition leader, she would have supported Juan Guaido as the opposition leader.
Mm-hmm.
That was the U.S. position. She would have supported the end or re-examining of the Cuban nurse program. That was a position of the U.S. She would have had her posture, now energy minister, then in the opposition, Mr. Rudolf Bunilal. He would have had a position where he was writing the U.S. government, questioning the then administration, supporting OAS incursion in their unilateral pronouncements. So all of these historical diplomatic occasions somehow all line up with U.S. policy. So I'm saying that I see a continuation of that. And I predict that the U.S. will have more influence in energy security. The discussions that the Honorable Minister of Energy, Mr. Rudan Munilal, he would have had engagement with the U.S. at Washington level. So we're going to see what that does. But I am saying the U.S. is intentionally putting their two hands around this, these twin island republic, and they are embracing us much closer. We need to know what are the pros and cons of such an embrace.
Of it, of course. And when we come back from the break, we're going to be discussing that and so much more.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio, Freedom 106.5.
It's called Diplomacy in the Age of Decibels, and we are talking about the tensions between Trinidad and Tobago and Venezuela. Welcome back, Mr. Henry. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
So before we went on the break, I told you that I wanted to discuss people and policy, right? Now, there are thousands of Venezuelan migrants living right here in Trinidad, some legally, some not. How could this diplomatic tension affect them? And is there any risk of rising xenophobia? Do you think so?
Well, good question. You know, we have a long history with Venezuela. By and large, they have integrated in our society at varying levels over time, at normal levels to the point where there was no restriction, visa restrictions for Venezuelans coming into our territory. This was on Venezuelans because of COVID period, for security reasons, for the high influx of migrants. So, by much, I would not lean on the area of increased xenophobia. What I would say from a sociological perspective is that Trinidad has to have a greater appreciation of what is happening internationally and also who Venezuelans are. So I will define that for you. You know, when you see the very strong migrant policy that President Trump is taking, and legally he's taking by all stretches of the law, you are seeing a lot of Mexican migrants who are inside of the U.S. They are rioting, they are fighting, they are pressing against this policy position. If you look right now, and it's not a guess, they are wrapped with their Mexican flags and they are fighting side by side, right, with people who share their views.
Yeah.
So, wise, we have to examine that if, and that's a long if, if these types of tensions rise up, we need to ask ourselves, who are Venezuelans?
Right.
Well, the first thing I would say, you know, when you look at Venezuelans, they are part of a socialist type system. And in a socialist type system, from ages 18 to 30, they have mandatory military service. Now, in Trinidad, the closest we get to any type of military service might be Cub Scouts and Girl Guides.
And cadets.
You know, right? If their parents make sure you go through cadets, like, right? But outside of that, we don't have that type of culture. Now, that's nothing strange. You know, Cuba has the same policy, mandatory service. Israel has the same policy, it's mandatory military service. You're dealing with citizens, legal or illegal citizens, who have gone through two types of training. One, military training, and also two, loyalty training, whereby the concept of socialism and love for country is ingrained in their DNA from age. So if you are talking about conflict, right, let's say, AKA, the U.S. supports us, or whatever that conflict is, you're talking about a large domestic population of Venezuelans living amongst us who will find some form of solidarity with their country.
That's the thought. And a lot of persons are saying or thinking that, listen, we have so many Venezuelans here, and how would we be sure that, let's say, for instance, if something is to happen, God forbid, if something is to happen, if they wouldn't turn on us
right
here on our soil? And that's what...
For us,
yeah? And that's what people are most, you know, should I say afraid or concerned with?
Well, it's a legitimate concern in the context of it could be along any continuum. Mm. It could be from demonstrations, which we saw. If we cast our minds back when there was a heightened tension in Venezuela, there were people who were supportive of then Juan Guaido, and they were protesting in Canada. That was like a foreign country, like, okay, what's going on? You should be
across there. So
there are people who will have solidarity. So the first continuum could be demonstration, it could be protests, it could be people gathering, it could be people raising their voices, expressing their concerns. Why is Trinidad having this anti-posture towards Venezuela?
Mm-hmm.
It could be on the other continuum of people who do support Maduro and find some form of consolation with him because the economic issues are directly attached to the high levels of sanctions from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me, which is not probable, but in international relations, some things are probable, but is possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of violence in that context. So it is fair for us to have a keen view on what those impacts can be. And it is very important for us as a society that when you see Venezuelans, I want you to know they aren't normal people. They understand a high sense of nationalism,
mm-hmm.
a high sense of patriotism. They are military trained. They have a basic understanding of fighting for their country.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, our posture shouldn't be anti-Venezuelan. We should simply be friendly to our neighbor.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know we are more or less are friendly. But, you know, sometimes, you know, the term desperate times call for desperate matters. And some people just take things overboard. Now, their culture is not like ours. And just right. as you mentioned and you brought to light that, you know, they have a good sense of, you know, standing up for their country. And they are very patriotic, very, very patriotic. So I don't want people to get that kind of fear in their mind state and that's thinking that, you know, if push comes to shove, something happens, you know, that all Venezuelans are going to turn against the old Trinis. Because as you mentioned before, there are some people who are not a fan of Maduro. And that's true. And there are some who are fans and some who are not. So, I mean, that's something that we have to look at and, you know, as a nation, we had to take that out of our minds just yet. Let's not even reach to that level of thinking. But let's continue. Now, we've heard both countries say they want to keep the dialogue open. Do you see that as a genuine effort or just a political performance to, you know, to ease the pressure? Because to be frankly, and I'm being honest with you, I think them just doing that because, you know, they don't mean it. You know, that's me, yeah? That's just me.
Well, you know, I agree with you in this context. So before we discuss, you know, what has changed, why it has changed, right? And now we're talking about what must change. And I did mention that we have to stop the diplomatic schizophrenia, right? Whereby we say one thing, we do another. And then you are alluding that sometimes we say things that really don't mean.
Mm-hmm.
So the keen focus, you know, the then minister of Foreign and Caricom Affairs, Senator Brown.
Amy Brown.
Amy Brown. He would have indicated that, hey, to the Honorable Prime Minister, he has contacts.
Let me help you, and I will come right up.
You know, and I will assist. And I'm in my mind, I'm like, come on. You know that's a non-starter, all right? There is no way a sitting administration who is new with a mandate going to reach across the aisles to mm-hmm. ask, you know, their recently defeated opponent, assist me with this diplomatic role. You know, so for me, to your point, I would have said quite frankly that the best advice the former minister could give is within the parliamentary framework where there's a committee for foreign and CARICOM for foreign affairs,
mm-hmm.
where he could ventilate, give advice, have a wide cross-section of views from independents that will inform and assist the government in formulating its policy. Because again, I say the prime minister and her cabinet has a right to set its policy, its international affairs policy. Mm-hmm. And no one can take it from them, but as a wider citizenry.
Right.
And those who form the parliament can give keen advice and support that can lead us to a good place. Because mm-hmm. as I said before, there is an upside and a downside to having this close friendly embrace by the US.
Yes.
And we need to examine the downsides of that embrace.
Of course, and you're absolutely correct. Now, Mr. Henry, we just have about 4 minutes away from our news. I'm going to ask you one question, and then after the news, we're going to join back the conversation. Now, in moments like this, we often look to regional institutions to help navigate the storm or to even get involved, intervene. What can a body like CARICOM realistically do when two member states are at odds? Can they play peacekeeper, or are they are their hands tied? What can they really do, like realistically?
Well, realistically, remind leaders of what is our position within the CARICOM, where we are a part and a keen focus of the non-aligned movement. We are a region and a zone for peace. So realistically, even as was done by Prime Minister Gonzalez, he would have, signaled to our Prime Minister, hey, let's, as we say in Trinity, let me pat it down. Let's not go along those lines. Realistically, we've seen the evidence of such success diplomatically when we saw tensions in Guyana for the elections.
Mm-hmm.
CARICOM been a stabilizing voice during that time of uncertainty. I'll use Guyana again. When we have the Essequibo issue with Venezuela, there was an agreement to really temper the tensions. And I would also, say from a regional perspective, we would have gotten a lot of support for having our president of the UN General Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
So CARICOM understands its role, the role of Trinidad. We have a very bright and, diplomatic history to be proud of, mm-hmm. of making effect. I think we had one of our regional partners enter the National Security Council
mm-hmm.
Of the UN, and I think Trinidad was also on track for that. So we have, from an evidential standpoint, have been able to punch above our weight in the past.
Yes.
So from that perspective, I believe as our regional brothers and CARICOM brothers and sisters, they would definitely remind us, our Prime Minister, and our citizenry that let's continue along those traditions.
Yes.
That will serve well for the future.
Of course. Well, thank you, Mr. Henry. So we're going to head to the news, and then when we come back, it will just be to wrap up our conversation and talk a bit about your article. All right? So stay tuned. We will be back.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio, Freedom 106.5.
So guys, let's head back into the interview, this discussion with Mr. Emwale Henry. As we are speaking about the diplomacy in the age of decibels, and this article he wrote, and it was very interesting. And when he's on, he would tell us where can we read the article. Welcome back, Mr. Henry. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Nice. So, Mr. Henry, let me just ask you just about three questions. I have three more questions to ask you before we close off. I mean, it was an interesting discussion, and, I love the way how you broke it down for us to the layman terms, more or less, because, I mean, we've been reading and seeing, and we don't really quite understand what's happening, right? So given everything that has unfolded between Trinidad, Tobago, and Venezuela, do you think that this was a diplomatic misstep or a necessary moment of recalibration between the two nations? What do you think?
I believe it was both. Mm. Both a misstep and an opportunity provided for us. It's an opportunity for a new administration to enunciate, clearly express its diplomatic position and its view of our region.
Mm-hmm.
Every administration has an opportunity to do such. It's also an opportunity for the Honorable Prime Minister to shape, which she has a clear right of, what direction and vision she has for our country. And it's also an opportunity for us to lean onto our traditions of cooler heads, as she has leaned into it by mm-hmm. indicating we are at peace with our neighbor. So the opportunities are right. But, to our original conversation, I talked about what has changed, why it has changed, and what must change. And what must change is the opportunity for us to widen our friendships across the region and across the world. Because the U.S. has always been a friend. The U.S. is actually an inevitable friend. We are its third border.
Mm-hmm.
We have deep friendly relationships with the U.S. The U.S. is a great partner to us across all sectors of society and a great champion for our democratic process. However, you know, I would ask the administration to consider not just what Barbadian Prime Minister Edward Barrow says, that, you know, as Caribbean people, we are friends of all,
mm-hmm.
but certainly none.
Mm.
And I'm expecting that our Prime Minister will also consider Foreign Minister Jaishankara of India. And he said that in international relations, we have to take what is called an all-aligned strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And what all-aligned means, good partners provide choices, smart partners take some of those choices. So for us, it will be in our interest, you know, to be a friend of Venezuela
mm-hmm.
and also of the U.S.
Yes, and I agree with that, you know. But unfortunately, the leaders of those countries, they don't see it like that, you know. It's either or. Either you stand with me or you be my enemy. I mean, and that's what we feeling, eh? That's what we're getting at.
But I would disagree with you on that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you why. You know, if we say that the U.S. is our friend, then, and I showed you evidence that this administration has been agreeing with U.S. policy from opposition into government,
mm-hmm.
and if they were in government before, I would say if we have this bromance with this new administration, the Trump administration,
mm-hmm.
then I would say to the administration, learn from the U.S., and I'll tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
We hear this conversation of Venezuela is a narco state and human rights are being,
mm-hmm.
you know, trampled upon, et cetera, et cetera. I would ask anyone, I would ask our entire nation and those who are listening. The U.S. engages, and I'll give just three examples, mm-hmm. Mexico, Saudi Arabia, China.
Mm-hmm.
And in a combined sense, the U.S. has over $2.6 trillion of investment with these three countries.
Mm-hmm.
I will ask the question, are those three countries examples of non-narco states, countries that do not trample on human rights, countries that have a centralized political system? The U.S. does trillions of dollars of business with Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
We are fully aware of Mexico's narco trafficking issue. The U.S. just did close to over $200 billion in trade with Saudi Arabia. We are fully aware of some of the human rights violations in Saudi Arabia. The U.S. does billions of dollars of trade with China, and China has a centralized political system.
Hmm.
So I would like us as citizens to not be bought into this romantic view of international relations. Relationships are not based on values. They spin on the axis of economic trade.
Mm-hmm.
And we can have an economic relationship with Venezuela, and we can also have an economic relationship with the U.S.
But what happens when, you know, the U.S., which is the administration of the day, you know, they are fully against Maduro, fully, right? What happens when, you know, they see us, you know, wanting to do business and, you know, being cool or being friends with them? What would happen to us then? What do you think could come out of that?
Well, what can come out of it?
Want to go get jealous? They go get jealous.
No, I can't say that. What will come out of it is diplomacy. Because to your point, I use the example of the Foreign Affairs Minister of India. India has deep trade relationships with the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very close with Russia. Russia is the mortal enemy of the U.S. And the U.S. tried to court India. They tried to court India. And that's what the Foreign Affairs Minister Jaishankara said,
mm-hmm.
that it is wisdom and it's part of your diplomatic survival
mm-hmm.
to not have one friend in your basket. You have, because no longer is the world unipolar.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Russia against the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bipolar, multipolar world. And because it's a multipolar world, we have to, because let's, the economy of the U.S. It could possibly go through a recession or some kind of issue, and we put all our economic eggs to one partner. We all know what happens, right? When the U.S. gets the cold, gets the fever, we get the cold, right? We catch everything that happens.
Yeah.
So my recommendation is we have to keep our economic, you know, eggs, you know, many eggs in various baskets.
Yes.
I would have recommended is let's look at Africa as a continent. We have the Afro-Exim Bank. The 7 of the 10 fastest growing economies is happening in the continent of Africa. Let's look at what we can extend across there. There are low-hanging fruits like medical, tourism, nomad visas, climate finances. There are so many things we can do across the region and across the world, and we should not truncate our diplomatic policy with one partner.
I agree with that. I agree with that, Mr. Henry. So as the rhetoric cools down and, you know, the both sides return to the table, what should be the top priority now to rebuild the trust, not just between the governments, but also between their people? What do you think?
What should be
the top priority?
For me, I think what should be the top priority would be, number one, yes, going back to our diplomatic conversations, but here's a unique. I don't think anyone has explored this. The U.S., which is their right, they are defending their petrodollar. Why? Because Venezuela has the largest oil reserve in the world. It's larger than Saudi Arabia. It's larger than Russia. So they know that the Venezuelan tapping into their resources can challenge the U.S. petrodollar. What is a petrodollar? Trading in oil reserves using the U.S. dollar. That's what gives it strength. So here's our recommendation, what we can do. We can pivot from energy with Venezuela to probably into agriculture. Venezuela has a thriving agriculture in livestock, a large thriving industry that can be beneficial to us. This is part of this current administration's thrust for agriculture, boosting our agricultural sector for export. So this does cut the line of energy threat towards the petrodollar. This might be an amicable way. And if anybody lives, you know, along the peninsula from Cedras, they will know what I'm talking about when it comes to agriculture. All right? Wink, wink, right? So it's happening right now. I don't need to say more. It's happening right now. Legitimize that. Let's harness that. It's in a whole different sector. It's, you know, our ecosystem, you know, if you talk to anyone who understands our ecology of our country, you know, our northern range matches with Venezuela. We have the same type of ecosystem, like a puzzle. We just pull off
Correct.
It's a good place for us to start. Venezuela has the land. They have the genetic composition of various types of livestock that can support another industry within our country. That might be a good place for us to pivot.
You know, now that you break it down like that, that making sense, you know. You know, and I really do hope that as time pass, you know, they see these things and they gravitate towards it and build on it. I think so. All right, well, Mr. Henry, as we close, as we wrap up, final question. What's your biggest takeaway from all of this that's happening? What should leaders in the Caribbean learn from this moment about handling conflict or communication or even diplomacy? What do you think that the Caribbean leaders should learn?
You know, it's time for us to move beyond reactive policy and to form a more visionary foreign policy strategy. And one that doesn't just whisper behind closed doors or shout across microphones, you know, but clearly, confidently, and on its own terms. Because in this new era of diplomacy, volume isn't power. Vision is.
And I hope they understand that by now. I really do. So before we go, Mr. Henry, tell us about where can we read your piece? Where can we read your article? Let us know, and even let us know your social media handle so we can follow you and check with updates. Tell us where we can read the book.
I do a lot of my analysis on LinkedIn. So LinkedIn.com/MwaliHenry. So you can follow me there. And you get a lot of different insights on different issues, international issues, economic issues, I'm really excited about what's available for our country. And I think this administration has the opportunity to make a great impact for our future development.
Nice. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and breaking down this, you know, with such clarity. And of course, guys, go check out the article on LinkedIn. You're looking for M-W-A-L-E Henry, and you'll find it on LinkedIn. Read the article because it's very interesting. And the way how he broke it down, you would be able to understand it. So I want to thank you so much for joining us today right here on Freedom 106.5 FM, Mr. Henry. And have an amazing day. Don't get wet. Try not to get wet, I should say. And, you know, keep warm, I should say.
Thank you so much, Carrie. And your program has kept me warm through this entire conversation. Aww. Keep on.
Nice. Thanks so much. Have a good one. We'll talk soon.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.